For the week of August 31st, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 247, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
At the Arthur Ashe Stadium in Queens, I'm Michael Giltz.
Did you lose your home or something? You're now living in a stadium?
I'm a tennis fan. I'm a tennis fan. I'm at the U.S. Open.
Oh, that's, I completely forgot about the U.S. Open this year. I do not know why. That's right. You basically, you're the ball boy, or you're the person that John McEnroe yells at, right?
My mother was.
Oh,
she was a tennis umpire. My brother has been as well. I was a ball boy, but I'm just a fan now. I love going to the U.S. Open. I had a great time with all the celebrities, of course. There are a lot of people there. I rode the train, though, with Jake Epstein.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Jake Epstein of Degrassi fame. Who knew he liked tennis? But there he was on the subway coming back. He's now on Broadway in the Carole King musical Beautiful, which is really good. I sent people to it. They had a great time. He was a Tony nominee for his performance as the late Jerry Goffin. And there he was, cool on the subway with his Avett Brothers t-shirt and watching on his phone with a friend the George Harrison documentary by Martin Scorsese. So lots of cool points for Jake Epstein.
Although when he was nominated for Tony for playing the late Jake Goffman, he wasn't the late Jerry Goffman at that moment.
No, he wasn't. So he was there. A lot of celebrities were there, of course. One celebrity that wasn't there, I don't think, is Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And I mention her because I always mispronounce her name. I always say Julia Louis-Dreyfus when it should be Julia King of France, Louis-Dreyfus. I always, add the S. I'm so annoyed at myself. I do it all the time. I got to start watching award shows again so I hear them say her name.
Yes, I guess we're talking about the Emmys in that regard because, of course, the Emmys were last week and she won for Veep. And thus you had to say her name. And I guess you must have mispronounced it. And somebody on the subway there, probably the person sitting next to Jake Epstein, must have reminded you, hey, I heard your show last week and it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus, not Louise-Dreyfus.
They didn't say it that politely, but yes. So that was last week. What's up for this week?
Well, on this week's show, this is the week of the summer, that part time of summer where absolutely nothing happens.
So our show will only be 90 minutes.
Right, exactly. It'll only be 3.5 hours. So unlike the 9-hour shows we usually do. But we'll be telling you how the world is coming to an end, really, because the North American summer box office is down 15%. Now, this news, which you will no doubt be reminded of throughout the remainder of the year, will have huge repercussions throughout the industry, with studios mothballing once popular comic book franchises in search of that next big blockbuster idea. That is until next year at this very time, when nobody can remember their doomsday predictions after Hollywood earns record revenue from an unprecedented number of monstrous money-making comic book franchise releases. Oh, and by the way, everyone else is wrong about this summer's box office. And Michael is going to tell you why. Thanks to listener CJ Flynn, we'll also talk about the battle in cities around the country between major tech companies and major tech, service providers who want to keep a stranglehold on the internet and some cities that want to offer high-speed internet as a public utility.
On Inside, more like disservice providers.
Oh, don't get me started. Seriously, this is not the week to get me started on that. On Inside Baseball, we'll explain why not all the box office dollars being earned are equal, especially those made overseas. That comes from a Ben Fritz article in the Wall Street Journal. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from this past week, so we'll probably have about three. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office, and indeed, the summer's box office.
That's right, and the number one movie around the world, this is based on findings from Rentrack, who we link to in our show notes, as well as stories in the Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and the LA Times. The number one movie around the world is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Why? Because it opened in China and it had made $52 million over the weekend. It's at $613 million worldwide. We'll explain later why this is great news and not so great news, depending on your accounting methods that you use. But it is, of course, the biggest hit in the Apes franchise history, and that's got to be good news for somebody. The number two movie around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy, another $36 million. It's at $550 million worldwide, and it has yet to open in China or Japan or Venezuela. So we're going to look at maybe $700 million when all is said and done for this franchise. That's what I predict. At number three around the world is Lucy. That's the Luc Besson film. It became the highest grossing film in Luc Besson's career. That's looking at worldwide box office. Another $33 million. The first in what I'm sure is a franchise starring Scarlett Johansson. It's at $270 million and counting.
Well, is it the highest grossing film in his career adjusted for inflation?
It's not, perhaps, because The Fifth Element is close to this number, but it's, you know, it's pulling away and it's not done yet. So it's still making $33 million a weekend. So I bet even adjusted for inflation, it will be the biggest of his career.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. And number four is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the highest grossing in that franchise, and it's far from done. It's at $275 million worldwide. At number five is Into the Storm, that B-movie about natural disasters. That's at $90 million worldwide. And number six is Let's Be Cops, which is basically a buddy cop film that has only opened mostly in North America. It's at $68 million. At number seven is If I Stay. That's a teen weepy. It opened, I think, last weekend, and it's now made $35 million on a very modest budget. At number eight is The Expendables 3. It's at $92 million worldwide. That's what it costs to make, but it's only in 37 territories, so I'm not sure where it is in its lifespan. How many more countries it has to open in, how much money it's going to end up with. Clearly underperforming in North America, dramatically lower than the first two films so far, but we'll have to see where it ends up. But if you're looking at flops, this is probably one of them of the year, and certainly there will not be an Expendables 4 anytime soon.
No, they're going to make it with women. It's going to be called Expendables.
Oh, is that what that is? I saw that. Well, that's cool. So you got
a... I think that's just a joke, but, you know,
No, I saw it listed in the numbers or something.
Yeah.
And why? Make what's her name from Terminator?
Terminator?
Yeah.
Linda Hamilton?
Linda Hamilton. You get Sigourney Weaver.
Weaver's out. She must have seen Expendables 3 and she said, yeah, no, I'm not doing it.
Sandra Bullock. I guess they're all two big names.
Yeah.
I guess you...
Bullock said, oh, I would do that, except I'm Sandra Bullock.
And number nine is How to Train Your Dragon 2, which we have seen stories saying it was a flop, followed by news stories now saying, no, it actually looks like a hit. So we'll have to figure that out for ourselves. But that grossed $11 million over the weekend. It's about to hit $600 million worldwide, passing easily How to Train Your Dragon 1. And number 10 is Hercules, the Dwayne Johnson flick. That's at $10 million for the weekend, $175 million worldwide. Just like The Expendables 3, that's only playing in about 30 territories. I'm not sure how much it has left. Again, it's figures we just don't have access to. How many countries it's played, how many countries it has to go, what countries those are, how much more it can look forward to making. We have to wait a couple weeks, a couple months to see where it ends up. But right now, it's at $175 million worldwide. It cost $100 million to make. So right now, it's a bit of a disappointment. But if it can get to $300 million, then it'll be a hit.
You know, when they showed clips of this film at CinemaCon, I just went, ugh, this movie looks so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was.
Well, it got actually polite reviews. People were like, it's kind of a dumb, fun movie. I almost went to see it this weekend. So, you know, we'll see where it ends up. You weren't expecting raves, were you?
No, not at all.
At number 11 is a cheapo horror flick called As Above, So Below. Mostly in North America, it's made $10 million so far. This is its opening weekend. At number 12 is Pierce Brosnan in a James Bond-like action thriller. He's a retired agent who comes back for one last score. And it opened modestly in North America, $9 million. But it was a cheap pickup. I think if they picked it up for like $3 or $4 million, it cost $30 million to make. They've probably sold it around the world based on Pierce Brosnan's name. So everybody would probably make their money back. And, you know, there's a couple other movies. Is there any big story? I don't think so. The biggest story, I think, is the big flop, which is Frank Miller's Sin City, A Dame to Die For, which is only in nine territories.
Only in nine territories, and it's made no money.
Well, it's in nine territories. It was a big flop in North America. It's not tearing it up overseas. Has a lot of ways to go, but it's only made $16 million. It costs $60 or $70 million to make. And as we talked before the show began, you know, how much does North American box office influence the world, et cetera, et cetera? Movies like How to Train Your Dragon 2 can make up a lot of ground overseas. But smaller movies, especially, are more vulnerable to how it does. You look at Sin City, this movie, and it was a big flop in North America. People hated it. They ran in the opposite direction. That will influence people. People in other countries will say, oh, great, we got to release Sin City. What are we going to do with it? Instead of a big ad campaign, they'll probably just dump it.
Well, okay, you just said something there. You said people will kind of shy away from it. The people that matter in this case are the film programmers, the exhibitors, the marketers.
They've already paid for it, right?
They've already paid for it. In a case like Sin City, I believe, who was releasing that? Lionsgate, maybe?
In North America or around the world?
North America.
It's a Weinstein Dimension.
So they probably did sell it already. So it's those, they probably have already sold that film.
Oh, yeah. People have bought it and they're like, great. Now their marketing budget suddenly is a little bit lower, or they're just not going to be enthusiastic about it. That can happen.
Yes.
You know, a bad box office performance can spread to the rest of the world. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Just like a good box office performance can make people step up to the plate and go, hey, we're going to make some money here. Let's make sure we do this right.
Yeah, although, you know, a film like How to Train Your Dragon 2, okay, if it bombed in the U.S., I mean, just completely bombed, sure, there might be some residual effect overseas. But the reality is, exhibitors, film programmers, distributors, they need content to show children during certain times of the year. They're going to play that movie anyway.
Yes.
It could be the worst animated feature of all time. They're going to play it.
And this was a well-reviewed film, so that also plays into it. You know, it underperformed compared to the original. It did not exceed it or match it, just a little bit below here in North America, but it got very good reviews. So that helps it also.
But we're seeing kind of the reverse as well. We're hearing, oh yeah, no, Captain America already opened in Australia and China or in the UK, and it's doing gangbusters. It's doing great. It must be a wonderful movie.
Yeah.
And so we're beginning to see that in the reverse being true as well, that international is helping drive North American box office on some films.
Absolutely. And of course, some international hits come here with a big stamp of approval. Movies that we wouldn't have paid attention to are getting released, are probably getting more of a push. You know, a French comedy, a South Korean action film. I'm seeing more and more of these movies in our duplexes here in North America. They're not making the big scores yet, but I am seeing like The Admiral, Roaring Currents. That's a big hit in South Korea. That's playing right on 42nd Street. Makes me want to go over and check it out. But the one movie that everyone has checked out is, of course, Guardians of the Galaxy. It's the number one film in North America, again, in the very slow Labor Day weekend. It's the top grossing film of the year so far. It's going to pass $300 million, the only film of the year to do that so far. So that is a big, big success story.
Yeah, especially one that came out of, I don't want to say it came out of nowhere, but nobody was expecting it to be this big, I don't think.
I don't think that's true at all. I think there was a ton of anticipation and it was a question mark. And they saw it as a big gamble. Oh, you know, not that Iron Man was well known particularly, but these are really obscure comic book characters. It was certainly a risk, but there was a lot of attention paid to it. It did not come out of left field. This was not a surprise, you know, this was not a shocker. It was just, ooh, how is this going to work? Well, guess what? Pretty good reviews, great box office, everybody's happy. It's the best success story of the summer for big budget movies. And yet, summer overall was a disaster.
Well, depends on who you ask, but yes. I mean, look, it's down 15% in North America. We're only talking about North America, okay? So let's preface that. And also, it's kind of what, the lowest year in box office history since 1997?
You can't say box office history since 1997.
I realized that as I was saying that sentence, that maybe I shouldn't have used the word history. Yeah, and I was wondering if you'd correct me. And the answer is yes, you were going to correct me.
Yeah, it's an 8-year low in summer box office. It barely cracked $4 billion. If you adjust for inflation, it's the lowest grossing summer in like 17 years. So not a good year. Ticket sales were down. Revenue was down from last year. Last year was, of course, the highest grossing summer in history. But hey, dropping 15% isn't good no matter what you're talking about. But even when you just say, oh, look, step back overall, it's the lowest in 8 years. And adjusting for inflation, almost the lowest in 20 years. Clearly not a great summer, at least in North America.
That's right. And we're going to be talking, by the way, so stay tuned. We're going to be talking about how international plays into this and how international plays into these figures.
Well, we're going to talk about it right now.
Oh, we are? Okay.
Yeah, you're talking about...
So by stay tuned, I mean like, you know, let's talk about that.
Right. They say the summer was a disaster. I say the summer was great.
And most studio executives are wondering right now, wow, what drugs is he on? I want some.
Are they really? Don't you think they pay attention to worldwide box office and how a movie does overall? Do you think the folks doing How to Train Your Dragon 2 are unhappy or happy?
I think that the folks who are in charge of wringing out as much revenue as they possibly can from that film, from How to Train Your Dragon 2, in North America, I think they're a little disappointed.
That's a worldwide play, though, isn't it?
Yes, but there are people, you know, there are teams, you know, there are domestic teams whose job it is to make sure that that movie does well in North America only.
Of course.
They could care less about the rest of the world, even though it, their jobs actually do depend on it down the line. Right now, their job depends on, did it do well in North America, where I had to market it, where I had to reap the revenue from it, where I have to then go to ancillary markets such as television and premium cable and DVD and digital and earn fractions or percentages of the original North American box office gross. That's what they're concerned about.
Yeah, but I don't care about the guy who needs to make their movie a success in Iowa. That is not important when I'm the head of a studio. What matters is the film a hit? Did it make me money? So if you're focused on some mid-level some important person who has to make it work in North America, fine. That's what they care about. But when we step back and say, is this movie a hit? Transformers is a hit. Did it underperform in North America? Yes. It made $1 billion worldwide. Don't tell me that movie's not a hit. Don't tell me the studio is worried about the film. We're thinking, uh-oh, we really blew it on that one. I mean,
no,
that's crazy.
What they are thinking is, gee, we really do have to contain the cost of this, because you know what? Yeah, they grew tired of it here in the U.S. and in Canada. Okay, fine. But you know what? The same is going to happen four or five films down the road in China. So we can't be spending as much money making these movies. And by not as much money, maybe we spend the exact same amount, but we don't, instead of spending $300 million instead of...
You're really, really, really confusing the forest for the trees here. It made $1 billion worldwide. Transformers: Age of Extinction is a massive success.
So
one of the highest
question is,
films of all time, based on its budget and based on the worldwide box office, based on the money it will make in ancillary, it's a terrific smash hit.
And what I would say is, how much money of that will the actual producer, in this case Paramount Pictures, see from that?
Well, we have to get that. We'll get to that in Inside Baseball. But looking at the big picture, do you look at the summer and the $1 billion grossed by Transformers and say, oh, what a disaster?
Well, I'll do you even one better. I'm not going to look at one film, and I'm not going to look at two films or even the box office revenue earned. What I will look at is attendance. Are people going to the movies? Because if people are going to the movies, then that's all that matters, because a habit of movie going is what matters.
Well, we don't have worldwide ticket sales figures.
I'm just talking about North American ticket sale figures.
The whole point of this section is to talk about worldwide. Compared to North America, it's like the North American box office was not great. Worldwide was sensational. That's my point. Why would you ignore the North American box office? I'm not. Do we ignore California when we talk about the North American box office? That's the biggest market in North America. Are we ignoring California by looking at the national picture? Of course not. So are we ignoring North America when we look at the worldwide box office? Of course not. Are there all sort of accounting things to look at? Of course. China is the outlier. You get 25 cents on the dollar. Most other territories, you get 40 to 50 cents on the dollar out of the box office gross, just like you do in North America. Ancillary is different in every country. Russia has terrible piracy. You're not going to make any money on home video, right? Other markets, you'll make a lot of money on video on demand. Another market, you make good on satellite or, you know, video on demand. You know, it just depends country by country. But it's a good thing to look at the overall worldwide box office and say, wow, this was a great summer. We had 20 movies I'm looking at that were the highest grossing films of the summer.
Well, what I would say before we move forward, if we're just looking at North America, okay, if we're just going to do that, I'd like to remind people of a couple things. Mm-hmm. Last year, 22 films that cost more than $100 million were released. 22, okay? Mm-hmm. This year, 12, okay? So fewer films were released. It's kind of like if you have 5 loaves of bread on your shelf instead of 55 loaves of bread. At the end of the day, you can't say, gee, I didn't make as much money today with 5 loaves of bread as I did yesterday with 55 loaves of bread. Yeah, you're going to sell fewer tickets to fewer movies. That does not shock me. So next year, when literally, as we know, John Fithian, the head of the National Association of Theater Owners here in North America, he started off the year January 1st by saying, hey, guys, I'm waving a flag here because I'm looking not to 2014, but I'm looking to 2015. And you guys there's like 900 movies being released in 2015. Maybe you could spread it out.
In the summer.
In the summer, yes. So please be weary of A, cannibalizing yourself, and B, totally kind of sinking 2014. And he was, I suppose, a little bit right.
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, last summer was the highest grossing summer of all time. But there were a lot of flops. There were movies that lost their shirts and people who lost their jobs. With almost half the number of films made, we only dropped 15%. A lot more movies made money this summer worldwide than made money last summer.
Well, you say people lost their jobs. I would say everybody lost their job last Sunday. You know, the head of Warner Brothers gone, the head of Universal gone. I mean, it was like a bloodbath last year.
So before we look at the hits worldwide, let's look at the flops. And there are only four films that made cost $60 million or more that are flops.
Okay. So
two of them are question marks because they're not done yet.
Okay. And so we're looking at worldwide. We're no longer just on North America, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So then this summer in the Northern Hemisphere, around the world, let's go. What were flops?
The biggest flop is Edge of Tomorrow.
That was a great movie. I love that movie.
Tom Cruise film, great reviews. It cost $178 million to make. It grossed about $350 million. Given his name and given everyone involved, I think it'll do great in the other markets, you know, on DVD, Blu-ray, video on demand, television, cable, satellite. It's going to be a good library title for years to come. Nobody's going to lose their shirt on this one. It's certainly underperforming, and it's as close to a big flop as you can get.
And that, well, that's not so bad, I guess, right? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, because first off, it was a great movie. Go see it.
Yeah, it happens. Hercules and the Expendables. Hercules cost $100 million. The Expendables 3 cost $90 million. They're not done yet. They're both got a lot of territories to go around the world, clearly underperforming. But Hercules may triple its budget, and the Expendables may do the same. We don't know yet. Expendables looks like a flop. Hercules is more of a, you know, missed opportunity, maybe didn't do great. We were hoping for more.
The funny thing is you say Expendables 3 looked like a flop. What I would say to you is it looked like a flop when it was a script, actually. So well, it kind of, you know, they actually did succeed in making that movie.
It's the third in a lame franchise. It's well underperformed the first two so far, but it's got a lot of territories to go. So we have to see where it ends up worldwide. We don't want to make the same mistake everyone else did on How to Train Your Dragon 2. We were there saying, well, hold on a second. Let's see where it ends up. And yes, as we'll get into Inside Baseball, every territory is different. You make less money here and over there and, you know, add the two minus the four. You know, it's a lot of accounting.
Carry the one,
but worldwide is very useful to look at for overall profitability of a film. So those two are big budget movies, $90 million and $100 million. They have not done great, but we have to see where they end up. The one clear big flop only costs $60 or $70 million to make, and that is Frank Miller's Sin City, A Dame to Die For. It cost about $60 million.
Wait, is it A Dame to Die For or Kill For? Because, you know, one is different. You know, you're either killing somebody or you're actually not breathing anymore.
Maybe it's A Dame to Kill For. I apologize. But it has grossed $16 million worldwide. It's only in nine territories, but the territories it's played in, it's been a disaster and people run in the other direction. And as you suggested, that will affect how it does around the world.
Yes.
Because, Did we talk about that on the show or off the show?
We talked about that sort of on the show, but mostly off the show. And basically what winds up happening is, you know, word begins to spread to circuits, and by circuits, I mean theater chains overseas, where they say, wow, that film is not doing well in the U.S. It got horrible reviews. Our theater exhibitor friends overseas, they're saying that it's, you know, really not doing well for them at all. You know what? Maybe instead of booking 50 runs of this, I'll book 10.
Exactly. Enthusiasm wanes,
right?
To put it mildly. So that's clearly, we're never discounting North America when we look at worldwide box office. Does how a movie play in North America matter? Absolutely. There are so many examples now of movies way overperforming overseas compared to North America that I don't think you can make any sort of straightforward function. Where it really matters is in a smaller film like Sin City, where it can get stamped with success or stamped with failure, and that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The big movies, however, the franchise, the brand names, they're going to open and play. People got a lot of money invested in them. And just because it doesn't do great in North America doesn't mean they're going to drop the ball once it gets overseas. But that's about it. There were a couple of $30, $40, $50 million movies that didn't do great. But that's it for big flops. Three movies.
Was there, and I would say, I think I know the answer to this, so I'm kind of being a lawyer in this case where
don't ask a question you don't know the answer to.
I think I know the answer to this. Was there a small and medium budget hit that, like, nobody was expecting or that, you know, was kind of an indie darling and kind of, you know, kind of a My Big Fat Greek Wedding, although that's kind of an outlier. But
that's a huge success. Yeah, there's lots of mid-budget films and small budget movies that were hits. You know, we could list hundreds of them. The 100-Foot Journey with Helen Mirren and Chef with Jon Favreau.
Yes, that's the one I would point to, Chef.
Right. Those are both success stories. And if you look at them, we'll be seeing lots of foodie movies in the years to come.
Well, let me ask you this. What about Boyhood? I mean, I keep sending people to that, and they go begrudgingly because I think the movie's about 900 hours long, longer than this podcast, believe it or not. And they come out and they love it.
That's right. Well, it costs $4 million to make. It's grossed $25 million so far, and it's got a lot of ways to go. And that's going to be a hugely profitable library title, because that's a movie people will check out on DVD and Blu-ray, will watch on demand down the road. So that's clearly a big success story from a very modest budget.
And it's probably an awards contender of some kind.
Oh, yeah. It's got a lot of room to go, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you know what I love is that I'll go to these kind of industry tech meetings. They're, you know, standards bodies meetings or work group meetings. And I hear some of these exhibitors, and they're all engineers. They're all techies. You know, they're the projection groups or the, you know, they're in operations, and they're saying, you know, what's doing really well at our circuit is this movie, the it's selling out all over the place. This boy movie, the Boyhood movie. It's I don't know what it's about, but people love it. And I'm just thinking, wow, okay.
And right. It's harder to keep track of movies overseas because nobody does sort of a roundup. I wish Rentrack would do a worldwide box office chart for the year and keep it updated all the time. What are the big highest grossing movies of the year worldwide? That would be really helpful, because once a movie falls off their chart weekly, we lose sight of it and we have to track it down and try and guess how much money it's made so far. But there are clearly a lot of medium budget hits from like countries like South Korea with The Pirates. That's grossing about $53 million and it's still doing well. In the UK, you've got The Inbetweeners 2. This is a movie spinoff from a TV show. Massive success. I think it's made about $60 million. And in China, you've got The House That Never Dies, a horror flick. You've got Tiny Times 3, and you've got Overheard 3. Those have all made like $65, $80 million, $50 million. So there's lots of success stories in the low and mid-budget level. But we're looking at the big-budget movies, and if you look at the top 20 films that grossed $90 million or more, and that includes The Expendables 3, and the top 20 films worldwide, you have got almost all financially successful films.
That includes Expendables. Wow. Okay.
No. But that's one of the examples that is not a success story.
Okay. Okay.
I'm saying that's one of the few that isn't a success.
Neighbors. Look at Neighbors. I mean, remember that movie?
Of course. Zac Efron, Seth Rogen, yeah. $266 million worldwide. We know there will be a sequel. And if they listen to us, it'll star Sorority Girls.
Yes. Preferably. Well, I won't go down that road.
Stop.
This is a children's show.
That's right. If you look at the franchises that came out this year, there are 9 or 10 franchises, depending on how you rank Guardians of the Galaxy. These are ongoing franchises. 8 of them were massive successes. They set records for their franchise.
So what are they? We're talking, I know X-Men was, you know, everybody thought, oh, that's it. They've really brought it back.
That's right. That's the record for the X-Men. Dawn of the Planet Apes set a record for their franchise. How to Train Your Dragon 2, Godzilla, 22 Jump Street, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Those are all records for their franchise. And then there's Transformers, which is not a record. It's the second highest, but it grossed $1 billion.
Yeah, and I guess when they're looking at that and there's some disappointment in their eyes, what they're really saying is, gee, in some territories, the luster has faded. And so that might happen in other territories as well down the line.
$1 billion.
No, I understand that.
They made 4 crappy movies, and they're grossing $1 billion.
I agree. I agree. But I mind you, they're thinking 10 years ahead. So, yeah.
Franchises do not last forever. And when you make 4 crappy movies in a row, it still made $1 billion. I mean, I understand in China, they made a lot of money and it's going to bring back less than if they made it in North America. I understand that. Significantly less, half as much as if they grossed that money in North America. Nonetheless, the only big flops you have in ongoing franchises are, of course, Expendables 3 and The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Okay.
Now, that cost $200 million to make. It more than tripled its budget worldwide. It grossed $708 million. Nonetheless, that is the record low for the Spidey franchise. But it's not dramatically lower. The Spidey franchise has only grossed about $750 to $890 million for the previous 5 films, right? $750 to $890. So this is at $708. It's lower. You don't want to leave $100 million on the table, but it's not disastrously
low. I did that once at a restaurant, and it totally was gone. Somebody took it.
I hate that. And now if you look at Guardians of the Galaxy, if you consider that part of the Marvel brand, that's done tremendously well. It's at $550 million. It'll end up at $700 million. Potentially, if it grosses $714 million, it will do better than Captain America 1, definitely, and even Captain America 2. It will definitely do better than Thor 1 and Thor 2. It's even doing better than Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2.
And that's might I say, what's important about this is 5 years ago, if I would have asked anybody about Thor or Captain America, they would have said, yeah, we know those characters. But if I would have asked those same people about Guardians of the Galaxy, they would have said, you're making that up, right?
Well, same thing with Iron Man. He wasn't that well known either compared to Thor and Captain America.
Yeah, that's true.
So those are all the franchises that were ongoing. Almost all of them did great. They set record levels. Godzilla is sort of a reboot, but that's one of those franchises that set a record, and they're making another one. Of the new franchises, Lucy will have another film. Neighbors will have another film. If they can kill some more kids, I suppose The Fault in Our Stars will have another film.
Oh, my God. How could you?
How could
I? They're children.
I know. I love them, too. There's a couple of Chinese and South Korean films in there. The Admiral, Roaring Currents, that's at $110 million worldwide. The Breakup Guru, that's a Chinese film. The Continent, not The Continent, but Continent, that's the film by Han Han, the Iron Man come alive. The what's his name?
Yeah, he like, you know what? I'd love to make this movie, but I have to go launch a rocket because, yes, it is rocket science. And you know what? While I'm doing that, might cure cancer and Ebola on the way.
While singing pop songs and blogging.
Yes.
So Han Han is a huge public figure in China. His directorial debut grossed $100 million. Again, two more big success stories. In France, that comedy, I forget how we translate, what are you doing to me, God? Something like that. This is that French comedy about parents with four daughters. They're Catholics. And each daughter marries a guy from a different religion, a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Jew, etc. Right? If it's not remade in America, I'll eat my shirt. It grossed $200 million worldwide. Now, that was released in spring in France and made a lot of money there. But I think it was playing throughout the summer in a lot of the world. And so I threw it in there as another example of a big summer hit. There's an asterisk by that one because like Captain America 2, that came out in the spring. That was a hit. Rio 2, that came out in the spring. We aren't talking about the spring. We're talking about the summer. But this movie played around the world in the summer and it grossed $200 million. And we love to cover as many countries as possible. So we had hits from France. We had hits from China, of course, and South Korea, of course, and North America, all over the world. You have to look wide and far to find a flop in that list of 20 films. You have to look wide and far to find a flop among all the movies that cost $90 million or more to make.
Of like course, say, at the end of the day, any studio or distributor or producer would tell you it all depends on how much money floats back to them.
Right.
Because they make the movies and they
pay. But it's a really good guess that if it triples its budget, they're going to be okay.
Well, now, if you could just vamp for a few more minutes here while I Google how to cook a shirt. I'd greatly appreciate it.
I'm just saying, look at the movies that were actually released. Like you say, last summer, 22 films were released in the summer that had big budgets. A lot of them flopped. This summer, virtually nothing flopped.
We still have asterisk marks. I still think, look, at this summer, everybody's going to think this is all such important news, 15% off. And next summer, they will have completely forgotten about it.
Right. So hopefully some of those, and they're not all comic book movies. We're looking forward to the next Star Wars movie and some other stuff. But hopefully they will move some of those to other time periods. Look how much success Guardians had in August. Well, that's a summer release date, but you know what I mean. February is a great time to release a movie. September is a great time to release a movie. Spread it out, people.
I agree.
All right. Well, did I convince you at all that this summer worldwide matters?
Yes, you did. But of course, I already thought that.
Well, did I convince you? I mean, I don't mean to downplay North America. I don't want people calling and say, hey, look, North America matters. It drives the engine of the world. I think that's less true now. I really do. You have to look at all these movies that we have examples of that way overperform. If you're making big spectacles that play well worldwide, you shouldn't be surprised if some anonymous flick like Transformers or Godzilla doesn't do great in North America.
Well,
why would they? They're just noisy nonsense that plays well worldwide.
Well, I'm going to tease our listeners by saying if you stay tuned to Inside Baseball, we'll tell you why not all box office dollars are created equal, thanks to Ben Fritz of the Wall Street Journal. But right now, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, for the first time, the head of the BBC governing body will be a woman.
Bloody hell.
Yes, I have to say, I was shocked. I thought, for the first time? Really? Is this story from, like, 1965? One of the most important and influential groups in the world, the BBC is hugely significant in terms of both its news gathering, of course, its culture, including TV and radio, and music and film, and even its innovations in technology. Amidst scandals ranging from child molestations by BBC stars to massive payouts to BBC staff, they have announced a new leader, and it will be Rona Fairhead, a former head of the Financial Times and other organizations, a figure with extensive experience in overseeing multinational corporations. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a softball. It's a big deal.
Okay. I mean, the BBC you know, we're not playing sports here, right?
That's right. I mean, you look at, like, in America, at least, a lot of our overseas news coverage comes from the BBC. The CNN uses them. Newspapers use them. They are incredibly important as far as how they cover the world. They're a hugely respected news organization, but they do a lot more than that. They have TV shows. They have movies. They have radio stations. People all over the world listen to the BBC radio. My mom goes to sleep listening to them at night. BBC World News on her iPad. She presses the app, presses the button. The show plays, and she's listening to the BBC because we trust their coverage.
Do you know what I love about the world news and listening to that?
What's that?
Is that when you listen to them, the BBC, they will actually, like, argue with the people they're interviewing.
Yes, yes.
Are you kidding? How could you say, don't you see how stupid what you just said is? And I'm just thinking, you know you're interviewing them, right? They could hang up on you at any time, and then you'd have to vamp until the next segment.
It's like Ted Koppel on Nightline. You know, they're not there to make noise, but they are there to question and challenge. They're not going to let people on there repeat something that they know to be untrue or misleading and let them get away with it. They're there as journalists. They're not there to make entertainment a la, you know, the 24-hour news channels where all they do is yell at each other. But they are there, like Ted Koppel, to ground people, bring them down, say, wait a second, these are the facts. You can't say it's been a terrible growth for jobs because jobs are actually at this. You know, so I think it's very respectful and entertaining and well done. But again, they're at a bit of a low as far as their reputation. They've had some troubles, and they've also got to renegotiate their mission statement. This is very important. Every 10 years, the BBC goes to the government and they negotiate what their mission is and how they describe it. And that sets their goals for the future 10 years. And that comes up in 2016, the end of the year. And so that's what Rona Fairhead will be in charge of. That's one of the big things, to decide where does the BBC go from here in the next 10 years. So making that mission statement, deciding where you're headed and how you're going to get there, is hugely important for how they do their job and what they fund and don't fund. And she's going to be in charge while they do that. So it really matters a lot.
Will Bruce Springsteen be the boss of picture books? By the way, great week to announce this, Bruce, because nothing else was happening.
Well, he wasn't trying to get attention for it. It didn't matter.
Yeah,
you know.
I know, because he would have gotten attention for it anyway. Dr. Yeah. Zeus might have something to say about that, of course, but Springsteen is definitely joining the ranks of rock stars who have created picture books, a list, by the way, that includes Jimmy Buffett, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, although I think his book wasn't meant to be a children's book. It just wound up that way.
Nice.
I guess three Beatles have also written children's books. In Springsteen's case, it's a book based on the song Outlaw Pete from his 2009 album Working on a Dream. It's going to be out November 4th. The work is being pitched as a picture book for adults, albeit one they can read to their kids as well. The illustrations are by Frank Caruso, who had the original idea, and the text is by Springsteen, who, of course, adapted it from his song. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's not that big a deal, but it's fun. I'm a big Springsteen fan. I think they're sort of downplaying how many rock stars have picture books, though. If you talk about songs that they've written turned into children's books, the list is endless. Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon, the list goes on and on and on. So there are a lot of children's books inspired by rock music and big stars. They don't necessarily sit down and draw the pictures themselves, but, you know, they are involved or they do sign off on it when it's done. So, you know, the list is as long as your arm. And which Beatle is the one that didn't do it? George Harrison. What's wrong with you, George? Get off your keister. John, Paul, Ringo, they've all done picture books. I don't know what's keeping George from doing it.
I'm just going to be polite here and say that I believe George Harrison is unavailable right now to do a picture book. He is previously occupied.
Okay. Well, fair enough. But, yeah, you know, his estate could get off their butt. Okay. I don't know what song you would do, though. Would it be My Sweet Lord? I mean, that's the only thing I can think of.
While My Guitar Gently Weeps?
Yeah, a little too adult.
Okay. Charlie Hunnam. Hunnam. I can never pronounce his name. You have a problem with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I've got a problem with Charlie Hunnam. or however you pronounce his name, he ran away from the 50 Shades of Grey franchise, which made me quite happy because I thought, oh, I'll never have to say his name again. But he ran away because he feared what a naughty 9.5 weeks like hit might do for his long-term career. And this from a guy, by the way, who first came to attention playing a teenage boy who seduced an older gay man in the explicit TV series Queer as Folk. But he's not afraid of all franchises. Hunnam has signed on to play King Arthur in the first of a potential series of movies directed by Guy Ritchie. The plan is to make 6 films because a trilogy is so 2010. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. Actor gets role.
Okay. Well, what about...
Hello, Karen Woodward.
Yes. Karen Woodward, our former host. Now,
by the way, Idris Elba might be signing on to play Merlin.
Ooh.
So that could be fun. And I forget who... I was going to say Maid Marian, but it should be Guinevere, of course, his queen. I forget who's potentially in the mix for that. We'll have to see if it's an actually good series, but 6 films. Good Lord.
I know.
Let's make one that's good first.
Well, now, let me ask you this. I threw this in because... when I was going through my RSS feeds and looking at all my news stories from the past week, all 4 of them, this particular story got like some ridiculous number of shares.
Really?
Tens of thousands of shares. It was that Chris Hemsworth and Charlie Day have joined New Line Cinema's Vacation. They're going to be rebooting Vacation.
With Chevy Chase?
I don't know. Basically, it looks as if Rusty Griswold will be the star, played by Ed Helms. He's the son, the grown-up son of Clark Griswold, which, of course, was played by Chase. And he's going to take his family on a road trip, similar to the one that he and his parents and, you know, his whole family went on when he was younger, probably the one that was documented in a movie, in fact.
But the gas will cost a lot more.
The gas will cost a lot more. Not only that, but do you know it closed August 15th?
Here in
Southern California, there is a theme park called Magic Mountain. It had this huge wooden roller coaster, and every time I passed it for the first like 5 years, I said, God, that roller coaster looks so familiar. It was the roller coaster in Wally World, the one that, you know, they kept talking about the whole is it Wally World?
I don't know. I never saw it. Any of them.
It was the roller coaster in Vacation that he keeps talking about wanting to ride the whole time. And
I
they get
it.
There and the park is closed. And okay, so apparently now the roller coaster is closed. Apparently, so is this story. But we should move on.
But it's happening. And I wonder why it got so much attention. I mean, Chevy Chase plays a cameo in the new movie along with his wife, played by, who is it?
Christina Applegate? No.
No. That's the new wife. Beverly D'Angelo.
Yes.
That was the one from the original Vacation. Again, I've not seen these films, but Christina Applegate, bizarrely, will be the wife of Ed Helms. That doesn't happen except in the movies.
That's true.
But yeah, they're making another Vacation movie. God forbid.
Wait, isn't Ed Helms married to...
We're talking about in the movie.
Oh, okay. Yes, true.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure Ed Helms' wife is very good looking and he doesn't deserve her.
I'm pretty sure Ed Helms is married to... Or maybe that's Jason Sudeikis. I don't know. I don't know who Ed Helms is married to. For Pete's sake, how
and
did
we
even get on that topic?
I don't know. Keep going.
All right, fine. Let's talk about Placido Domingo. Apparently, there was this little contest over the weekend. Operelia, the American Idol-like competition for the world of classic music singers. They sing opera. It came to Los Angeles, as it always does every year, created by Placido Domingo. The event, which is really just a straightforward showcase for talent, not really a reality TV series. It has launched some young careers since beginning in 1993. The host city for the finale changes every year to emphasize the worldwide popularity of classical music and opera. So I take that back. I guess it's not in LA every year. This year's winners include tenor Maria Chang, or Mario Chang, not Maria Chang, from Guatemala, and soprano Rachel Villis Sorensen of the U.S. 2 other Americans ranked second, Los Angeles native Joshua Guerrero, who is a tenor, and American soprano Amanda Woodbury. And as Michael has written here, USA, USA, I guess because it's a sporting event? I don't know.
USA, USA.
Oh, okay.
Just a joke.
Okay. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It is a big whoop. Oh. Now, it's nice. I like that Placido Domingo started it. It looks like it's bringing some attention to opera and classical music, which I love. So that's great. It's interesting. And there have been some talents that have arisen from this contest that have gotten some prominence. So that's great to see. So perhaps these people have big careers. And it's nice to see the strong presence in America. If you're a fan of, you know, American classical music, and you want to see great performers. Of course, they go around the world. So we'll have to see how that happens. But it's good. It's good for them. It's not a big deal. It's just an annual event. However, One interesting thing I learned was that in classical music, almost everybody who is taking part is already coming from the upper middle class or the wealthy, because those are the only people exposed to classical music. They're the only people who even think of it as a career. And so more and more, you're seeing the people who get drawn to it and try and explore it. Of course, there are counterexamples, but it seems like a lot of the people who enter into the world of classical music, especially opera and singing, are in fact coming from the upper middle class and the wealthy. And that's a shame, because you're losing out on a pool of talent. And people, of course, broadly are not listening to classical music or opera. And that's a shame, because if you want the people of the future, you got to reach young people today and so on. So I'd be fascinated to know the backgrounds of these people. When were they exposed to classical music? How did it happen? Just an interesting side note. I didn't realize how sort of blue-bloody classical music had become, but I guess it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. And now I will say that Anna Netrebko, who's kind of a, you know, phenomenon. Oh,
there are always going to be examples. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She actually got discovered. I think she was the janitor or the, you know, kind of a maid at the ballet school, and she was singing, you know, as she was cleaning, and somebody said, "Hey, you've got a good voice. You should you should go on and become a huge, you know, worldwide sensation as an opera soprano." And it kind of worked, actually.
Well, by the way, according to news reports from the Washington Daily News, this is breaking news. Ed Helms apparently just got married.
Are you serious?
Like August 31st, they're saying looks like he got hitched to his long-term relationship, which they don't even say who that person is, and they don't even say the gender of them. So that's kind of weird too. I'm not implying he's gay, but I'm not sure why it doesn't say, you know, the gender. That raises my alarm bell a little bit. Makes me think, huh? So that's not been specified, but apparently he may have just gotten married. Some fans have tweeted, "Oh, he got married. It should have been me." Oh, there've been so many rumors. They look like a happy couple. Somebody tweeted, blah, blah, blah. But it's just not sure what's going on. But he may have gotten secretly married literally over Labor Day weekend.
And even if you were implying he was gay, that wouldn't
I
really
imply stating or saying. I'm just wondering why this news story doesn't specify the gender. It doesn't say long time, you know, it doesn't have a name, doesn't have a gender, at least it's gender nonspecific. That raises my question of maybe they're, you know, that's the case. Who knows? He doesn't care. He's a good guy.
That's true. Now, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And in fact, you're finding out news as it's breaking here on Showbiz Sandbox. We're going to move into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I would say this story, written by Ben Fritz of The Wall Street Journal, the headline is, "For Hollywood, not all box office dollars are equal." The way it's going to affect you is if Hollywood can isn't going to earn as much overseas, they have to watch how they make and spend money on movies and which movies they make. How will it affect you? Don't expect a lot of dialogue.
Well, but that's not because they're not making money overseas. That's because they are.
Right.
All right. So this is a really good article. Everyone should read it. It says some things that we've been saying for a long time, but it also breaks some new territory as far as he's trying to come up with a formula to say, all right, if this movie grosses this much in North America, how much will it make for the studio over the next decade? And it's fun and it's interesting. Every movie's different. We recognize that. You can't use one, you know, formula for something like The Fault in Our Stars, which cost $12 million to make and made most of its money in North America, and another movie like Transformers, which made most of its money overseas. If you listen to our show, you know China is the real outlier here. You only get 25 cents on the dollar. So if you gross $100 million in China, you're probably only pulling out $25 million, which is a big difference than if you gross that same money here. In North America, you'd have made $50 million if you're the studio. That's how much money you get back from the distributors. So every movie's different. Every country is different. But it's fascinating to look at. So Sperling,
yes,
talk us through this. Tell me something.
All right, so
if I release a movie in Russia, what's going to happen?
Okay, so you've released a movie in Russia, and it's made what, $100 million?
$100 million, and I own the rights to it. And all, you know, let's pretend I own the rights to it for everything: the theatrical box office, DVD, Blu-ray, video on demand, you name it.
Okay, so from box office, you've made $100 million. Of that $100 million, theater owners will give you $38 million. So that
that's
means
it. Yes, Russia's really low.
Yes, so they are keeping 62%. Basically. And I hope I just did the math on that one right. I think I did. 62%. So when you basically release a movie over there, the theater says, thank you very much. I'm selling this product, and I will mark it up by about 38%. So, you know, I'm going to keep 62 cents of every dollar that comes in.
So if you own the rights to it on DVD and Blu-ray and all that other stuff, okay, will you make it up in ancillary markets? That is DVD, Blu-ray, rental, video on demand, TV and cable and satellite sales, all that sort of stuff.
You won't actually get to, according to these figures, you actually won't get to $100 million. But television, you'll make another $10 million. DVD and Blu-ray, you'll make $15 million. So you're up an additional $25 million. And mm-hmm. digital, which is now just kind of emerging in at least legitimate digital, it's just now emerging in Russia, you'll make an additional $2 million. That's as of today, over the next 10 years. So if you make $100 million this summer on a big blockbuster film in Russia, over the next 10 years, you'll get the $38 million in box office. That comes almost right away. Over the next 10 years, you'll make $10 million in television, $15 million in home video, $2 million in digital, for $65 million in total over the next 10 years.
And that's really sort of net?
That
Are we
is,
talking about net?
Yes, that is money coming back to you.
Yeah, that's cash in hand.
That's cash in hand. Whereas right. in China, that same $100 million, you'd walk away from the box office with $25 million. There is really no DVD market to speak of, at least not a legal one. No digital. You're not going to get your stuff on digital, at least not, you know, because China controls that. So you'll make $2 million between television, digital, and DVD. You'll make an additional $2 million. So really, you're talking about a 27% take home from your $100 million box office there. The part of the problem with both Russia and China that is really not addressed in this story, because it's kind of out of the purview of this story, is the issue of misreporting box office. And by that, I mean the theater is kind of saying, hey, yeah, we made $50 in ticket sales. They're basically not reporting properly. This is a big problem in China that China itself is trying to crack down on.
And it's happening less and less around the world because there are so many multiplexes now. And with ticket sales being via credit card and all that, it's harder and harder to hide the money.
It's harder. But the reason they want to do so is not just so that they can keep more money for themselves and not so that they can kind of rip off the distributors, but it's also for tax purposes. They're saying, no, we don't. We shouldn't be paying those taxes. We didn't make that much money. But that just has the residual effect of not actually reporting box office correctly, which does affect the studios. And
you just confused me. You're saying they're hiding the money, not just to screw over the studios, but just because they don't want to pay taxes. So
Correct.
They're screwing over the government. We don't care who they're screwing over.
But
they're lying about
some...
how much money they gross.
Yes.
But it is getting harder to do that because of the automation, right?
Yes.
You're buying tickets online. You're paying with a credit card. It's a lot harder to hide that money these days.
And China is actually going after some of these theater chains and theaters that are doing this. And I think not only because of the tax issues, not only because, I'm sure Hollywood is kind of asking them to, but also because they know, hey, if they're doing this to Hollywood movies, they're going to be doing this to all movies, including the ones that are made by Chinese filmmakers, and we don't want that to happen.
So to recap, if you gross $100 million in Russia, your American studio, you predict, will maybe bring back how much money overall in the next 10 years?
In Russia, $65 million.
And in China?
In China, $27 million.
That's it. And in North America, now, if you gross $100 million in North America, what can you expect to make over the next 10 years?
Now, here's where I'd like to start showing the difference and highlighting some differences, specifically pointing towards television and some of these ancillary markets and how important television is. In the U.S., 50% you take home from box office. So you make $100 million at the box office, RentTrak reports it, we report it here. $50 million you're walking away with. That's almost right away because you're going to collect that before the year is out.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next 10 years on television, you're going to make $60 million. That's more than you made in box office. Okay.
Wow.
$40 million will come from DVD and Blu-ray sales, so home video. That's almost as much. It's four-fifths of what you made in box office. Then you have digital. And you're going to make $25 million in digital over the next 10 years. So your $100 million box office earner just made $175 million take home.
So when you say $60 million in television, what are you talking about? You're selling to cable? Are you talking about video on demand? What are you talking about?
No, video on demand would probably be digital.
Okay.
So television is like if it's on FX, if it's on the USA Network, if it's on TBS, if it's on BBC4 in the UK.
HBO or Showtime.
Yes. In the US, we're only talking about US networks, but HBO
right.
would be premium television. So that's a whole other. That's why, by the way, with television, you see all these Windows. Oh, it's on HBO now, but next month or 2 months from now or 4 months from now, it won't be. The reason why they create all these windows is it's one more way to sell the same thing to somebody new.
And we're all happy. We like innovation and we like, not making every movie cookie cutter. But when you're talking about a big Hollywood movie, they'd be pretty foolish to release it on video on demand day and day, because that's going to mess up with all the money they can make on cable and television, right?
Right. And so when we were talking earlier about, well, does North America really matter? Well, here's where it matters, at least for those just working in the domestic market. Usually it's about 25%. Now you're saying, what did he just say? Where did that come from? That was a non sequitur. 25%, and it does fluctuate, and this is kind of an old figure, I know. So before those of you who work in this particular part of the industry, write in to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. I realize 25% is just one of the figures that used to be bantied about in years past. 25% is the amount that premium cable and pay TV will pay for a particular title.
If your movie grosses $100 million,
they
pay a fee of 25% of that total box office gross in North America in order to secure the rights. They agree in advance, all right, whatever your movie makes, we'll pay you 25% of the box office in order to show it.
Thank you for summing up what I was apparently having trouble trying to say. Yes.
So let's recap again. Your movie grosses $100 million in North America. It will net you. Net? Is that the proper term? It's not, because we're not talking about the budget. But it will gross you about $175 million over the next 10 years.
You were actually correct the first time. It will net you $175 million.
Well, but it depends on your budget. If it costs $800 million to make, you haven't netted anything.
You're
absolutely
right. Revenue coming back to the studio will be $175 million. Right. Now, whether that means you made money or lost money, I can't tell you. But
right. If your movie grosses $100 million in Russia, the North American studio itself will take back about $68 million.
65.
If your movie grosses $100 million in China, you will take back about $27 million.
Right. Now, the UK, here's something that's interesting. You've made $100 million at the box office. As a studio, you can expect these theater owners will keep 70% of that. You will only get $30 million back. Now, television, again, showing how important television is, especially in Western countries, $50 million over the next 10 years you will earn from that film. Again, home video.
The UK is only 30%? You only get back 30% of the box office?
Yes, and that is why.
Well, forgive me for yelling at China. Why aren't they yelling at the UK? Why is it so low?
Oh, it's been an ongoing battle, and it's getting better in the UK. But this is, and remember, these are averages, so it's not always,
right.
Yeah.
But it's the rough figure that's probably about right overall. When you add up all the differences, it ends up being about 30%.
Right.
Wow. Why is it so low in the UK?
I don't know. That's something that I should actually research.
Wow, I apologize to China again. I mocked them. Like, join the real world, join the UK, and give us 30%.
Well, if you look at home video in the UK, you'd make $40 million. So $50 and $40 million more than you'd make in theatrical box office. $50 million in television over the next 10 years. $40 million in home entertainment over the next 10 years.
So if your movie grosses $100 million in the UK and you own the rights in these other areas,
you're walking away with $130 million. Dollars revenue, again, not net, because you'd also make $10
million. So that's almost as good as the U.S. Why is it so? It seems confusing that the other markets are so big. That's why they get less in the box office, because you're going to make so much more on TV and DVD. I mean, $130 million out of the U.K. market for $100 million gross is almost as good as North America.
Yes.
Wow. So that's great. So you're looking at a movie. If those four countries, it grosses $100 million in each country, which isn't going to happen, but we're just trying to compare and show you how much you can make in the ancillary markets and how much you get actually back in box office. In North America, you're going to pull back $175 million over 10 years. In England, I should say the UK, $130 million. In Russia, $68 million or 65. What was it?
In where?
In Russia, it's going to be about $65 million. And in China, $27 million.
Right.
So, wow, you can see. 175, what was it, 25?
130.
130, 68, 27, 65, 27 million. Wow, you can see $27 million in China. Still, again, this is why you're angry, because you're not making any money on TV. You're not making any money on Blu-ray and DVD. You're not making money on ancillary markets. It's a joke, basically. So there's a huge room to grow in China.
Yes. Well, and again, we were talking about, does international matter? Does North America matter? Really, here's what you can take away. Okay, so even though Transformers Age of Extinction, the most recent Transformers movie, will probably make more money than, or will make more money than Transformers Dark of the Moon, which was the 2011, I think, the third.
Well, that one, it still needs to make $100 million. I think it's probably done. I mean, as far as worldwide box office, I don't think it's going to pass it. I think it's done. So it's fallen just short, but they both made $1 billion.
They both made $1 billion. However, this most recent film will actually bring back in revenue to Paramount Pictures tens of millions of dollars less than the previous film, which earned just as much.
Because it did so less well in North America.
Correct.
So, yeah, again, if you're looking at overall box office, North American box office powers the world. It sets the stage for a lot of countries. You make more money in North America, both in pure box office and in the other markets, than you do anywhere else in the world. But the rest of the world is growing and it's catching up.
Right.
And so lot of movies that you look at when you say, okay, every territory is different, but there's a lot of money on the table. And the bigger hit the movie is around the world, the more money you're bringing back.
Well, and as Joe Drake told Ben Fritz here, Joe Drake is a founding partner of the independent film company, Good Universe. He said, look, what we're all doing, what we're all striving for is that when these foreign markets explode, they bring in additional revenue rather than cannibalizing existing markets. In other words, what he's saying is we're putting our chess pieces on the board right now. Yes, we're earning less revenue from all of these different markets. That's today. Right now, we're just trying to open the door.
Well, they're making less revenue than they potentially could if they had the same deals in place that they do in North America.
Correct.
But these are smaller and newer markets. They're exploding, and they're making a lot more money worldwide than they ever did before.
Correct.
All right. So I say again, you look at the box office of North America, look at how many fewer films opened up that cost a lot of money. If you add up the budgets of all the movies from last summer, that record-breaking summer, and add up the budgets of all the movies this summer, you're doing better this year. You know, half the movies, and you're, you know, barely a non-profitable film to be found. You know, the worst case scenario is like Edge of Tomorrow or Expendables 3. Big deal. Vast majority of the movies made money, no matter how you slice and dice it.
Well, that brings us to listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We have an email here from Cyrus N. He's from sunny Los Angeles. He writes, I'm assuming it's a he. Do you want to read this one, Michael?
No, you read this one. I'll read the other one.
Okay. It says, hey, Michael and Sperling. Great show. I love listening every week or more recently whenever you post a new episode. Low blow. I'm only writing in now to weigh in on the discussion you had over why Craig Ferguson would announce his departure as host of The Late Late Show, saying he wanted to pursue something other than a talk show, and then soon after begin negotiations to do a talk show on another network. That is, if reported rumors are accurate. It is not uncommon for talents such as Ferguson to have what is referred to as a quote-unquote Prince of Wales clause in his contract. These clauses are usually in place so a network can retain alternate talent for a program, whether a variety show or a newscast. And that is, should the primary talent retire, quit, or meet a tragic end. The idea of the clause is that the network must offer the secondary talent the option of taking over for the primary talent, on whatever programming is stipulated in the contract. In this case, in the case of Ferguson, his Prince of Wales clause would have guaranteed him the hosting position on Late Night if and when David Letterman retired, quit, or got fired, or so on. If the network first offers the Late Night hosting spot to someone other than Ferguson, there is a monetary fee which must be paid to him. Here's the catch, though. For Ferguson to collect the fee, he likely has to not be hosting the Late Late Show within a set period of time, usually 12 months. If he is still hosting his regular show on the same network at the end of that time period, he is probably not eligible to collect the fee. The thinking is that by remaining on as the alternate talent, Ferguson is in a sense agreeing to play backup, nor is he losing his job, thus the fee need not be paid.
In other words, he's got to quit. If Letterman goes, he has to go or he doesn't collect his money.
Right.
Okay.
By leaving before the time period expires, he triggers the clause, collects the fee, and has the freedom to look for work elsewhere. Some reports have Ferguson walking away with as much as $40 million from the clause. However, my experience in such matters leaves me doubtful. Conan O'Brien earned as much in the whole Tonight Show debacle, and with all due respect, Ferguson is no O'Brien, at least not when it comes to audience size. The more accurate figure is probably the $5 to $12 million reported by such media outlets as Gawker, link attached, and others. Keep up all your great work, Cyrus N. from sunny Los Angeles. We've got the link.
All right, Cyrus. Well, thank you very much. You're absolutely right. Never pays to not be cynical. Let me say, how do you say that? It never pays to be, well, how do you say that?
It pays to collect $12 million. I think
it pays to collect $12 million. And you should always be cynical when looking about why people are doing something and when and how they do it. Certainly, I'm sure that's a factor in Ferguson stepping up to the plate and saying, yeah, I'm gone. I got to step away because, you know, there's a lot of money to be made and he's probably ready to leave. Clearly, CBS made clear they were not supporting him. They did not like him. They weren't going to push him for the late show. That was obvious. So, you know, it's time to go. Do you want to hang on for another year, lose your money, and then be fired? Or do you want to walk away with your dignity intact on your own terms and get a nice big fat check? However, the only thing I will add in here is that none of that surprises me, and I really appreciate you pointing that out and giving us the link and talking about it. That's certainly useful as far as the timing. But my issue was not with the fact that he would leave and do another talk show. My fact was that he made such a point of saying, now I know you think I'm being fired, but that's not the case. I'm done. I'm ready to move on. But he could have just said, I'm leaving, and you can all figure it out for yourselves, and then later done a new talk show. But he went to the ninth degree to insist that he was just, you know, he'd done enough talk show. It was time for him to move on. And that's what I took issue with, because I like him and I trust him. And I really felt like he was going overboard to say, hey, don't think I'm being fired. No. It's all good. I'm leaving on my own terms. I was ready to go. And then Letterman announced and blah, blah, blah. So he really, you know, laid his heart on the line and made us believe, no, this is what I want to do. When clearly it wasn't, because he's doing another talk show.
Yeah.
But this is fascinating. The Prince of Wales clause is important. It's definitely placed into his timing and good money to be made. And I'm sure he's absolutely right that this was a key factor in why he stepped to the plate and just said, all right, I got to get out of here.
Yeah,
they're going to kick me away in a year anyway. They clearly are not. They're going to let me play out my contract and then save an extra $12 million. You know, but the writing is on the wall.
Right. He basically looked ahead and he said, okay, so they're going to let me stay on until, you know, Stephen Colbert takes over and that kind of settles itself out. They might let me stay on maybe even 2 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. But they're not going to give me another contract. And the only reason they're keeping me on is so that they don't have to pay me this $12 million. I think I'll leave now.
Well, and Letterman, of course, owned his show, and now CBS owned the show, whatever. Letterman was, you know, helped make the show, launch the show. So again, he lost his big supporter. Once Letterman goes, there's nobody there with his back. Not that there was love lost between them and Letterman anyway, apparently, at least the companies.
Yes.
I don't mean to say there's ill will between the two fellows. I doubt they talked much. But you know what I mean. I'm saying everything was changed. Letterman was gone. Nobody had his back. The network could now mess around with his show because Letterman wasn't there anymore, saying stay away from my show, blah, blah, blah.
You know, it's funny because I know a couple of baseball players who, some of whom were at the beginning of their career, some of whom were at the end. They're Major League Baseball players, and they actually, you know, a lot of their contract clauses have things like at-bats. Like, you have to have a certain number of – that's a way
stupid
of keeping people healthy. So, if, you know, we'll pay you, provided that you're actually getting at-bats. But some people some players realize that, oh, gee, if I get traded to a team that, say, has another second baseman, then – I might get platooned. I won't get my at-bats. In fact, the general manager might force the manager to platoon me specifically so that certain clauses in my contract don't kick in.
Yeah, there are all sorts of little cute clauses that you come up with that have unexpected repercussions. And those are very good examples. Suddenly, players who are injured keep playing because they want four more at-bats to get their thing triggered when they should be resting and get healthier for the postseason. Things like that. So, yeah, you know, you always got to worry when you get cute. Too many, you know, just keep it simple. That's my advice. But I guess that never works in contract world, does it?
Now, speaking of simple, here's one from CJ Flynn.
This is simple. This is very straightforward. Hey, Sperling and Michael, there are other articles out there with more info than this one, but this is the one that made me think that I should send you a note to make certain that you're on top of this story. Maybe you are. I am a few showbiz sandbox issues behind. He probably doesn't have enough time in the day. The big companies are going crazy with cash to anyone they can give it to block more municipalities from offering internet and TV services as part of the infrastructure conversion to smart utilities that is happening and needs to happen. It's an extremely cool thing to have a utility company that is set up as a defined profit entity, also providing what will soon be just another community utility anyway, that is the internet. Have fun, CJ. And he links, or she, I should say.
No, it's CJ Flynn. He's been a guest on the show.
Oh, oh, I beg your pardon. Of course, I'm an idiot. I didn't see the last name in here. That's why I didn't know who it was. You didn't have Flynn written in there.
Sorry.
It just said CJ. So my apologies. He links to an article in The Guardian, that's in the UK, talking about U.S. telecom giants calling on the FCC to block cities in America and their expansion into high-speed internet. What we have basically is in North America, you have utilities. That is local, basically
phone companies.
Simple little companies that offer electricity or water to people's homes. They make money, but it's very modest, and they're not big, high-flowing companies. They're basically monopolies, but they're overseen and regulated so that they basically provide the service. Everybody gets it. Everybody's happy. Doesn't cost a lot. The service is good. Everyone's glad, right? But we also have the internet, and the internet is controlled by a few huge telecoms, and they hate cities and states offering internet service as a nonprofit utility. We'd love it to be a utility around the country because they do such a bad job, you know, via the telecoms. So what happens is the telecoms are trying to fight this off. There's a growing movement to provide utility service as a public utility, meaning everybody gets it, it's cheap, and it's great. Yeah. Of course they hate that. They want to have crappy service that costs a lot of money. So in cities and states around the country, some cities are experimenting. They're offering the internet as a utility at much higher speeds and at much lower cost, and the telecoms are fighting it every which way they can. Basically, they pay off politicians on the city and state level to pass laws that they pretend is to protect consumers, but is in fact to end competition and make sure no utilities step in and offer cheap internet to everybody. So there's internet wire, fiber wire all around the country in some big cities that's sitting there dormant, not being used because of these stupid laws. The cities could offer cheap internet service that's great, fast, and inexpensive, but they can't because a law has been passed at the city and state level to say you can't do it. And in the cities and states where that hasn't happened yet, where they haven't been able to pass a law blocking it, the telecoms are stepping in to try and pass a law.
Well, and this all matters because the reality is we're all going to be getting our entertainment at home over cable or fiber in probably 5 years. I wouldn't be shocked if cable TV, well, in 10 years, I wouldn't be shocked if cable TV goes away and it's all IPTV. But
that's right. But somebody's got to provide the internet, and the telecoms want to make sure it's them because they make a ton of money off of it. And other people want to make sure it's a utility like water and electricity. We should have better service for less money. It's gone beyond some cute little add-on, and it's actually an essential function in life now. It's important for business. It's important for security. It's important for families. It's important for access to the world of information that the internet represents. And you just cannot have a serious world in which you don't have running water. You don't have a serious community without electricity, and you don't have a serious community unless you've got access to high-speed internet at an extremely low price.
Now, let me tell you what has happened to me, and I'm going to make this short. First off, Chattanooga, okay? This has nothing to do with me, but Chattanooga has its own municipal citywide kind of broadband, okay?
It's a public utility.
As a public utility, so they're not exactly, you know, sending their kids to college off of it. 1 gigabit per second is the speed they offer, which is 50 times faster than the U.S. average. And I can tell you, 50 times faster than the line Michael and I are now using to record this very show.
Wow.
Actually, it's probably larger than or greater than 50 times. So recently, I have Earthlink Internet Access, which is a company here in the U.S. that has kind of fallen by the wayside. It's kind of like AOL, if you will. But even worse, because they really have no other business. I know that for business, they're fine, but for home and residential services, they're not so great. For some reason, I got kicked off their landline. I have no idea why my landline, which was with them, my telephone landline, I can't get a dial tone. I get kicked off. They tell me, look, there's nothing we can do to restore your service. You're going to have to find another provider. Okay, fine. I go to Time Warner Cable, since they are my cable company, and say, all right, guys, you finally got me. I'm going to become a subscriber or a telephone subscriber. Can I bring my number with me? Oh, no problem. Not a problem at all. Well, I now know more about local number portability in this country, the United States, and by the way, in other countries, than probably most people who work at Time Warner Cable and most people who work at most telecoms, because I spent an inordinate amount of time reading over the FCC documents and the FCC laws and the documents that are released to proposed rules before they get actually legislated, because all of a sudden I could not port my number from Earthlink to a new provider. I haven't moved houses. I haven't moved geographically. Why can't I do that? Well, lo and behold, the simple version is that the number was assigned to one provider. In this case, let's call them Sprint, okay, or MCI or AT&T. It wasn't Time Warner Cable. It was assigned to somebody else. So that number in the big giant database in the sky will always be assigned to that provider.
So it's not assigned to you.
Yes, and it has to be rerouted. So when you call me on that landline, Michael, if I have another provider other than the original, if I've ported that number and thus, quote unquote, contaminated it, they're called contaminated phone numbers. It then has to be rerouted by the original provider to the winning provider, in this case, Time Warner Cable. Now, you might think, why is this guy boring me with all of this nonsense? And it is nonsense. It's minutiae. It's arcane. It's archaic. Why does this matter? Because Time Warner Cable, which used to actually use MCI and Sprint and just resell their service for phone, they actually decided to go with on their own. They get phone numbers assigned to them now directly from the big group that does it, just like Sprint or AT&T. They just get phone numbers assigned to them. However, to have a number forwarded to them or routed to them, as it's known, through a switch, through an exchange, a phone exchange, and this all happens through equipment and it's all electronic and, you know, automated and nobody has to actually physically do anything. Well, Time Warner Cable would actually have to have what's called an interconnect agreement with my previous provider. In this case, let's say it's Sprint. Now, you might recall this little word interconnect, okay? That's the same type of agreement Netflix would have to have,
right,
with Time Warner Cable. Or not Netflix, but Level 3 or one of these big backbone providers that Netflix uses as their, let's call them UPS delivery services. They would have to have a pretty robust interconnect, which, by the way, costs money. So Time Warner Cable can't port any of these phone numbers, not because it's technically impossible. It's not. It's because they refuse to have an interconnect agreement with anyone.
So that's that they can get you to pay more money to get a new number and keep you as a trapped customer.
Well, not only the whole trapped customer issue is another story, but we all pay and have been paying for decades for this little fee, because of course, Time Warner Cable is supposed to pass that fee and can and is allowed to pass that fee, that little monthly fee, it's like a 50 cents or something like that, on to us customers. And
it
in fact, if you look at your telephone bill, there's all these little things at the bottom of it in the US, mm-hmm. A wireline fee, an FCC fee, a this fee, a that fee. One of those fees is a number portability fee that we've been paying for decades, long before people even knew what number portability was.
But who gets the money?
The phone companies. And yet, Time Warner Cable has not done anything to actually live by what the FCC wants.
Right. So this is an example of the problem when you have a monopoly.
Correct. This is all a long rant to say competition, competition, competition.
Well, but public utilities are not competition. Well, they are, I guess, for private, but they would be replace it. There is no public. There's no competition for water or electricity. It's just a public utility.
Yes.
So I would say no competition. Public utility.
Okay.
When something is so basic and important to our infrastructure as the internet is, as running water is, as electricity is, the time for companies to be making tons of money with crappy service is over. It's too important. Our public roads should not be all private toll roads. That's not a smart thing to do. That's how we began, and then we converted to public roads. We used to have private companies doing our fire department business. We said, that's stupid. We got rid of it. We used to have private companies providing security. We said, that's stupid. We got rid of it. We think if we have private companies handling our internet, it needs to end.
You heard it here first. Well, if you don't agree with us, and you know, heck, you might have some thoughts on it of your own, why not write to us? dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can call and leave us a voicemail and we'll play it on a future show. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, any podcatcher that you use, that's where you can usually find us. And we do ask that you rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can also find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show or to contact us, or you can follow us on Twitter. Our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should show up. All of that information, again, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website every week. It changes. What is it this week, Michael?
I still love you, CraigFerguson.com.
Wow. Okay. You know, if you have trouble finding any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry in the book world there, try michaelgiltz.com or run on over to the Huffington Post and search for his name. I'm sure you'll find a few stories there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.